Good afternoon, everybody. I think we're going to get started. My name is David Myers from the Department of History here at UCLA. I'm delighted to welcome you to this afternoon's seminar with Professor Marina Rustow from the Johns Hopkins University. I'd like to thank the Center for Jewish Studies and all the co-sponsors for allowing this opportunity to hear from Professor Rustow. This might be a good opportunity to power down your cell phones if you have not yet had an opportunity to do so. Marina is with us today as part of a just-concluded conference devoted to Geniza research. We are very privileged here at UCLA to host some of the world's leading scholars of the Geniza documentary materials who were convened and brought together by our colleague, Professor Jessica Goldberg, and I understand that it was a most stimulating and productive meeting. We really had the opportunity to concentrate here the world's leading authorities on Geniza research with the intention of advancing Geniza research further to the next stage of development, the next digital stage in the 21st century, and we look forward to further fruits of that important research. Today we will hear from one of the participants in that meeting, Marina Rustow, who is, of her own accord, one of the most interesting and important historians of medieval Jewry writing today. She has written extensively, indeed published her first book on the Fatimid Caliphate and the Jews, research that draws on a period between the 10th and 12th centuries in the Mediterranean region, focused in Egypt, but extending into North Africa. And I would say that one of the characteristic features of Marina's work, it's almost a cliche at this point, is her interest in the permeability of borders. In that first book, she was very interested in the permeability of the boundary that was once assumed to be ironclad between two groups of Jews, the rabbinates and the Karaites. They were often and frequently understood to be at each other's throats, and indeed the most vigorous of polemical adversaries. What Marina showed in this book was the extent to which the boundary between them was actually traversed very frequently. And they interacted opportunistically when it was in their shared interests to do so with the ruling regime. That feature of inquiring in and around the blurred border is really one of the hallmarks of Marina's work. She's generally interested in the way in which we should see, not as as diametrically opposed, the world of Islam and the world of Judaism in the context of the Fatimid Kingdom, Caliphate, how we should understand rabbinates and Karaites and various other groups who operate in that world. She's currently at work on two projects that draw on her expertise in Geniza materials, those discarded materials that were found in a synagogue in Cairo and have become this extraordinary trove of material for the reconstruction of Jewish, Islamic, Mediterranean, and world history. The first of the two projects she's working on analyzes the use of Geniza documents for understanding better the Fatimid regime, the polity itself, and the way it interacts with its emissaries throughout the world, particularly throughout the Mediterranean region. The second project is one that uses Geniza materials to understand better the life and interactions of Jews in the Fatimid world with the regime and others, non-Jews. So these two projects are proceeding in parallel from the same source of Geniza materials. Say one final word about Marina. She brings not only mastery over and command of Geniza materials, which requires tremendous linguistic dexterity. She also possesses a tremendous command of many different intersecting regional and world histories. And perhaps what really lends her uniqueness is a conceptual rigor and sophistication that very few possess. All of this makes her a very unusual scholar, and I suppose the final comment is she happens to be a student of the great polymathic historian Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, and any student of Professor Yerushalmi is welcome at UCLA. Without further ado, Marina Rustem.
David, thank you so much for that very warm and very generous introduction. For a while, I felt like you understand me better than I understand myself. Then you got really, like, over the top. thank you so much, and thank you to the Center for Jewish Studies for inviting me, and to all the co-sponsors, and to all of you for coming. I'm really grateful to have such a large and seemingly enthusiastic audience, although we'll see in an hour. It's said about Freud that he had two desks in his office, and whenever he was stuck on one project, he would just turn around and write the other one. That's not what I'm doing. As David mentioned, I am in the middle of trying to complete two books, and I'm taking them seriatim. It was supposed to be one book on Jews and the medieval state, and how did Jews' interactions with governments in the Middle Ages both determine the character of their community and also shape the way the governments ruled over them. As I was writing that book, I came to understand that there was a lot of propedeutic work to be done that hadn't yet been done, that I thought had been done but hadn't. So I started doing that propedeutic work myself, and that's the book that I'm currently completing, which is a very kind of close and in some ways technical study of the process of how people actually interacted with the government via documents in the 11th and 12th century in Egypt and Syria. Even though this is basically a talk on Jewish history, it's also a talk on medieval Middle Eastern history. And one thing that you're going to notice when I start showing slides is that a lot of what you're going to see is not in Hebrew script, but in Arabic script. I'm going to explain the reasons for this in a moment, but I just want to say two kind of introductory things. One is that in the period that I study, which is kind of writ large, the 10th through 15th centuries, but especially focusing on the 10th, 11th, and 12th, the vast majority of Jews on the planet Earth lived under the rule of Muslims, of Islamic dynasties. So it is literally not possible to understand Jewish life in the Middle Ages without understanding something about the Arabic-speaking world. The second thing, more broadly, is that this is really part of what I would call the new Jewish studies. Both David and I are the product of a mentor who was very much part of a generation in which, although it was understood that you would know Hebrew and rabbinic literature and also understand the languages and the cultures of where the Jews that you study lived, there was still, I think, an assumption of some impermeable boundaries between Jews and others. And that sense of boundaries has really fallen away in the last kind of 20 years, and there's a lot of new work being done that kind of takes into account the fact that things were a lot more porous than we once imagined. So you're gonna see some of that in what I'm going to say today. So just to introduce you a bit to the time and place, the Fatimid caliphs who conquered Egypt in 969 and ruled until 1171, they actually arose in North Africa in 909 and then gradually moved eastward. They're not the best known Islamic dynasty now, but anyone who lived around the Mediterranean basin in the 10th and 11th centuries would have recognized the Fatimids as the superpower of their day. In 909 in central North Africa, the Fatimids declared themselves caliphs, which was a very radical thing to do because it challenged the very theory of sovereignty on which the Islamic polity had been founded three centuries earlier. There was supposed to be only one caliph who ruled from Baghdad in the name of the Abbasid dynasty and who was considered to be the vicegerent of God on earth. And all of a sudden in 909, there were two. Then in 969, the Fatimids marched eastward and they conquered the very wealthy tax-rendering province of Egypt, slicing it off of the Abbasid caliphate and dealing basically what was the fatal blow to the Abbasid polity. So after that point, Islamic empire would be fragmented for centuries to come. The Fatimids built a capital city at Cairo, the city victorious, when they conquered Egypt, and then they went on to conquer Syria, by which I mean the entire Western Mediterranean littoral, up until Byzantium, including Jerusalem. And they then won custodianship of the sacred Islamic precincts at Mecca and Medina, which meant that they were staking a claim to spiritual leadership of the entire Islamic world. And they very nearly arrived at the gates of Baghdad itself. So they were really a very, you know, kind of force to be contended with in their day. The Fatimids never conquered Baghdad, but what they did do was to catalyze a kind of decisive economic and demographic shift away from Abbasid Iraq and westward towards the Mediterranean basin. So if you read a late 10th century geographer who himself was a product of this kind of westward migration because his grandfather had come from Iran to Syria, he said, Egypt's metropole, the twin cities of Fustat, Cairo, have superseded Baghdad until the Day of Judgment. So in various parts of the Mediterranean, rulers kind of took note and started instituting building programs and campaigns of royal propaganda that were intended to imitate the Fatimids and kind of beat them at their own game. The idea is the Fatimids set up this political vocabulary and everybody had to then speak the Fatimid language and kind of beat them at their own game. So the first person to do this was Abdurrahman of Cordoba. He proclaimed himself caliph in 929, so now there were three. And he then built his own Palatine city, Medinat az-Zahra, the ruins of which you can see outside of Cordoba today. And he modeled them after the early Fatimid capitals of North Africa. Two centuries later, the Normans of Sicily built palaces and churches in and around Palermo, employing Muslim and Byzantine craftsmen and iconography, and using Islamic architectural vocabulary. They staffed their entire kind of bureaucratic apparatus with Arabic writing scribes who modeled their documents on Fatimid documents right down to the characteristic script. In other words, all this by way of saying that the material remains of these kind of three Fatimid centuries attest to the very, very long shadow that the Fatimids cast over the Mediterranean. So you really can't understand Mediterranean history in this period without understanding the Fatimids. Much less widely discussed, although I would argue just as important for Mediterranean sovereigns, is the subject of my talk today, which is the Fatimid sovereign tribunals. Under the Fatimids, anybody could submit a petition to the caliph or to high-ranking members of the government for redress of a grievance. And the grievance didn't have to be particularly important. It could be something like, I am having trouble repaying a debt. Can you please help me? Or it could be something quite sort of official sounding, including, you know, an edict was issued to my community 5 years ago about a certain issue of land tenure and it hasn't been enforced. Can you please issue a rescript to the local governor and ask him to enforce the terms of this edict? So in other words, official petitions, personal petitions, requests for money, employment, land grants, forgiveness of debts, exemption from taxes, rescripts of investiture. People knew that they could petition the state, and subjects of the Fatimids made kind of pervasive use of these tribunals for pretty much the entire period of Fatimid rule. So why did the caliphs encourage this? I mean, you know, it's kind of a pain. You receive all these documents, you have to process them. The bureaucrats of the period actually complain that these petitions would just kind of like end up, you know, on the chancery floor because there were too many of them to deal with. So why did they bother to do this in the first place? I would argue that they did it not out of liberality, not out of a sense that subjects' grievances really needed to be redressed for ethical or moral reasons, but out of self-interest. Because a subject's complaint could provide the caliph with a very convenient pretext to dismiss a corrupt or overweening official and confiscate his ill-gotten gains, right? The official, the local emir stole my 70 bags of grain. So you write to the caliph and you say, may I please have them back? And the caliph says, oh, goody, this is an opportunity for me to sack this this corrupt official. So in a way, the rulers were sort of using subjects against their mid-level officials, while at the same time playing the personal patrons to their subjects. The idea is that they sort of garnered legitimacy throughout their caliphate by successfully conveying the impression that subjects could turn to them for redress. And in fact, authors of chancery manuals under the Fatimids, in other words, people who served in the Fatimid state apparatus itself and then wrote books about it, actually say that petitioning was a method of garnering legitimacy for the sovereigns. Somebody named Ibn Asayrafi, who was head of the Fatimid chancery for almost half a century until his death in 1147, put it this way. Rescripts in response to petitions concerning grievances. This is an aspect of issuing rescripts, but an important one, since it involves people claiming justice from each other and the establishment of the laws of justice in the realm, And because most of those with grievances are powerless people, paupers, and unprotected women. Unprotected women is a trope in this literature of kind of the ultimate, most powerless member of society, meaning a woman who doesn't have the benefit of male patronage, generally from family members or from her husband. Most of whom arrive from the most distant and remote parts of the realm, believing that they are approaching someone who will help them and redress their injustice and assist them against their adversaries. So what Ibn Sayyafi is doing here is kind of emphasizing the importance of responding to petitions for the sake of the regime's image in the eyes of its subjects. And he's totally aware of the element of publicity. Responding to petitions is important because people believe that they're seeking redress from someone who's in a position to offer it to them. So the regime had better give them what they expect so as to keep up the appearance of establishing justice in the realm. So petitioning quickly came to serve the Fatimid claim not just on legitimacy but also on universal sovereignty. Meaning it wasn't just Muslims who were submitting petitions to the palace, but also Christians and Jews. And that kind of statement of we are caliphs over everybody, regardless of their confessional loyalty, was also part of Fatimid kingship. And that aspect of their governance also attracted imitators. So the very same Abdurrahman III of Cordoba, in 955, undertook a sweeping administrative reform in which he established sovereign tribunals on the Fatimid model. And I'm not going to actually read this text in the interest of time, but there's a historian who tells us about this, saying that he imitated the ways of the Muslim... Sorry, this is somebody else. The Norman kings of Sicily in the 12th century also established sovereign tribunals, and it's an Arabic writing historian who tells us about this and says that this Christian king imitated the ways of the Muslim rulers rather than the Frankish ones by founding a sovereign tribunal. So the idea is that this idea of petition and redress was something that was particularly associated with Muslim rulers, and in this period with the Fatimids in particular. The problem is that the writings of all of the chroniclers and chancery officials and Muslim jurists together give us a very incomplete picture of how these tribunals actually ran on the most kind of quotidian, worm's eye, pragmatic level. We just don't know who wrote petitions, who conveyed them to the palace. We know a little bit about what happened inside the palace once petitions were submitted. How were decrees then publicized outside? There's a lot we don't know. This is only to be expected, because if you think about the biases of the kinds of sources that I just mentioned, who are the chroniclers? The chroniclers are professional creators of sovereign propaganda, right? So they're trying to represent the caliph as responding personally to his subjects, and generally what they do is talk about how the caliph rode around on horseback and personally heard entreaties, and then would kind of like, you know, issue rescripts on the spot, which stretches the bounds of credulity, all the more so when you look at sources on Roman emperors who are said to have done exactly the same thing. This is a very, very long trope, right, about the personal investment of the sovereign in responding personally to his subjects, especially on horseback. The chancery officials can't be trusted that much more because what they're really interested in is kind of the technical skills or alternatively the ethical qualities that royal scribes needed. And they, to the extent that they tell you how petitions were answered, they only really talk about what's happening on a very technical level, kind of in the private secretary's chambers within the palace. And as for the jurists, the Muslim jurists who are kind of responsible for codifying Islamic law, they basically just want to tell rulers how to run their affairs in accordance with a kind of Platonic version of God's law called the Sharia, which makes them really unreliable for an actual description of what's actually happening. They wanted to bring practice in line with their ideals of Islamic law, but that doesn't mean that they're telling us what was really going on. So this text that I just brought you from Ibn Sayyafi is unusual for kind of, he's one of the very few medieval authors who actually deigns to see the process from the petitioner's point of view and to bother with the details. If we want a really fine-grained picture of how all this works, that includes not just palace officials, but also petitioners and the lower officials who are responsible for kind of making the whole system run, what we need isn't chronicles or mirrors for princes, but we need to have a look at the actual documents that these tribunals produced. Here we run up against a famous, or at least oft-cited, I mean famous to like the 10 people who care, or oft-cited problem, which is the supposed dearth of documents that survive from the medieval Middle East. So the Middle East before the Ottoman conquests in the 15th and 16th century is widely believed to have produced very few documentary texts. and to have preserved even fewer for posterity, until the Ottomans came along, and then they were great document producers and consumers and preservers, and the Ottoman archives will take people literally centuries to actually comb through. But even specialists in medieval Middle Eastern history tend to kind of draw invidious comparisons between what they study and medieval Christian Europe. Like, oh, you guys who study the Latin West are so lucky, you have documents, we have nothing. The reality is a lot more complicated than that. In fact, for the period until about 1000, it turns out that the Middle East has preserved more documents, more original documents than the Latin West. But the general kind of, you know, theory that has been put forward for decades is that in the Latin West, documents served as tools for the preservation and reproduction of legal and social privileges. But in the Islamic East, those privileges were a monopoly of autocratic rulers who bestowed privileges arbitrarily, if at all. And so what was the use of documents in a regime like that? The fact that medieval documents survived in European archives is supposed to have demonstrated the strength and the stability of Western institutions, while the medieval Middle East is supposed to have lacked those sorts of stable institutional structures that could have supported, you know, a robust culture of documentation and law. So let me just hasten to add that this is complete nonsense. Between regime change and Oriental despotism, documents in the Middle East didn't really have a fighting chance, and nobody was paying much attention to what might actually have survived. But we know, if you actually even read the chroniclers and the jurists carefully, you know that documents must have been produced in abundance in the context of statecraft, law, trade, administration. And even just, you know, kind of to take the long view, to take a sort of commonsensical view of this, the Middle East is the region that invented writing, state administration, and archiving, right? If you go all the way back to the Babylonians, you can see that there's a long tradition of statecraft via documentary production, and that means that these Islamic dynasties inherited institutions that were founded on the production, exchange, and preservation of written instruments. So if that's the case, right, in other words, if we kind of had this hunch, or we know from chronicles that documents must have been produced, where are they now? Writing documents is not the same thing as preserving them in archives, let alone preserving them for posterity, for our posterity. So in other words, you can demonstrate that these documents existed, but it's much less clear where they went and when they went there. So contrary to the usual lament, there are documents from the Middle East. There are plenty of them. A couple thousand have been preserved in small archives, such as the Monastery of St. Catherine in Sinai, which still preserves an archive. Much of the material is still on catalog. Some of it was microfilmed by an American expedition in the 1950s, but apparently that's only the tip of the iceberg. Other documents have survived in archaeological deposits, including tens of thousands of Arabic texts written on papyrus, mainly from Egypt, a few from Syria. And still others, the ones that I'm going to talk to you about now, survived in a completely unexpected place, the worn manuscript repository of a medieval Egyptian synagogue. This is the Cairo Geniza. Documents from the Geniza are unique in offering us more evidence than any other cache about how the medieval Arabic state archive might have actually looked and why it disappeared. So let me just say a brief word about what the Geniza is. The Cairo Geniza was a hoard of manuscripts and documents that were preserved in a medieval synagogue in Fustat, which was the residential quarter south of the Fatimid Palatine city of Cairo. The congregants who prayed in the synagogue, like most Jews of their time, believed that any piece of writing in Hebrew potentially bearing on the name of God or containing the name of God shouldn't just be sort of casually discarded, but should be deposited, disposed of in some more respectful manner, either buried in the ground or stored in a special chamber until it could be buried. So when this particular congregation built their synagogue in the 1020s in Fustat, they installed a chamber for worn manuscripts, a geniza, that was so large that it never actually had to be emptied. And when European scholars eventually found out about the Geniza in the late 19th century, it contained somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 folio pages, the vast majority of which date to between 1000 and 1250. So perfect for anyone who happens to study the period that I study. These are now dispersed across dozens of libraries and private collections. They're in the process, I would say, even at the end of the process, of being photographed and digitized, which is wonderful. I mean, my work has been completely transformed, as has Jessica's, by the availability of these digital documents. When we were graduate students, this was not the case, and we work very differently now from how we used to work before. If you want to know something about the discovery of the Geniza, there's a wonderful book by Adina Hoffman and Peter Cole that talks about how the documents were discovered by Europeans and why they're no longer in Egypt, but I'm not going to talk about that today. The vast majority of what's in the Geniza has turned out to be Jewish religious texts. And one might expect that, right? Their find spot was in a synagogue. This was the repository that largely literate members of the community used. You'd expect to find lots of copies of rabbinic literature, the Bible, prayer books, tons and tons and tons of liturgical poetry. But a sizable minority of what was preserved in the Geniza are documentary texts, by which I mean letters, contracts, all kinds of legal documents, testimonies, accounts, trials of the pen, recipes, prescriptions, grocery lists, all the kind of ephemera of daily life that really give us a very intimate picture of the society. The vast majority of these are in Hebrew script. I'll just give you kind of one cute little example. This is the nigh illegible handwriting of Moses Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher. He's writing in Judeo-Arabic, which is Arabic written in Hebrew characters, although if you read Hebrew and you look at this and you're not used to reading medieval manuscripts, it might look more like Arabic than like Hebrew. But no, it is indeed Hebrew Hebrew characters. Only here he's not philosophizing at all. He's being completely mundane. And what he's doing is he's writing a little kind of post-it note to somebody saying, there's going to be a meeting, an ishtima'a, in the synagogue, fiyom sipt, on the Sabbath. And by the way, your letter reached me, but it was so wet that I couldn't read it. It's kind of like, you know, the ultimate excuse in the 12th century. Like, you know, I got your email, but it got stuck in my spam filter, so I'm not responding until now. You know, who knows if it really happened. And then here in the margin, he says, don't be late. So all kinds of things like that kind of surfaced in the Geniza, and it's wonderful stuff. So these documents are of unparalleled value in reconstructing not just the history of the Jews, but of the medieval Middle East more broadly. UCLA's own Jessica Goldberg has used these documents extensively to reconstruct the culture of business and long-distance trade in the period. I've used them to try to understand what medieval Jewish communities looked like from the inside, and now I'm using them for a very different purpose, which is to try to figure out more about the Fatimid state that ruled over the Jews when the overwhelming majority of Jews lived under Islamic rule of one sort or another. It was enormously fortunate that the Geniza survived in Fustat. This is a map from Jessica's book. The maps from Jessica's book get used a lot in conferences. I don't know if I've told you this. I was at a conference in Rome in mid-September, and at least three people brought maps from your book.
Ooh. Occasionally people actually ask me for the high-quality things, but I didn't know.
I didn't know there were high-quality things. I'm glad I know now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can send them to you. They're huge.
So during the time period that the Geniza covers, the twin cities of Fustat, Cairo, were first of all the center of the civilized world, and second of all, they sat astride two very important orbits of trade, the Mediterranean trade and also the Indian Ocean trade. So what this meant in practice is that it increased the geographic ambit of documents from the Geniza, and we really get a huge picture, vast picture, kind of, you know, the Iberian Peninsula all the way over to India. But Fustat was also cheek by jowl, as I was just telling you, with the center of government in Cairo. So if you were going to look anywhere for traces of the lost medieval Arabic state archive, you may as well look in the Geniza. Scholars have been engaged in deciphering Geniza documents for more than a century. There's still no complete catalog of them, which of course is like really annoying for those of us who work with them. But at the same time, it means there are a lot of pleasant surprises and discoveries to be made. And one of the most exciting discoveries for me was the realization that the Geniza actually preserved hundreds of Fatimid state documents of precisely the type that might have been preserved had the Fatimid archives survived for posterity. It's just what we would want them to be. Petitions that people presented to the state tribunals, the rescripts and decrees that the chancery drew up in response to petitions, even internal bureaucratic memoranda that were sent from one government office to another, tax receipts, other products of the fiscal administration. I find tax receipts incredibly exciting. I'm probably the only person on the planet Earth who does, maybe one of two, but I love that stuff. So these kinds of documents provide us with a very granular view of how Egypt and Syria were governed in a period that was long believed to be kind of laissez-faire or chaotic or autocratic. I mean, all kinds of crazy theories that weren't based on kind of the day-to-day, study of day-to-day government functioning. It's a little weird that these documents were preserved in the Geniza, given that they're in Arabic script, right? The Geniza's raison d'etre, as I was just telling you, was to preserve in a kind of limbo, permanent limbo, texts written in Hebrew script. Mm-hmm. And even more odd is the fact that a lot of the documents that the Geniza preserved in Arabic from the state have absolutely nothing to do with Jews, which makes us ask the question, how did they get there? How did they get not only into the Geniza, but how did they get into the hands of the Jews who put them into the Geniza if these documents have nothing to do with Jews? So take, for example, this set of manuscripts that you're looking at now. This is what specialists in our subfield called a join. It's a set of fragments that fit together like pieces of a puzzle. It's one of the most spectacular joins I've ever seen. It's based on 7 fragments from 3 libraries on 2 continents. It was put together, 6 of these were put together by Ronnie Shweka, who was just here for the conference that Jessica organized. And the 7th, the top piece, just came to the attention of him and me and our other collaborator from a doctoral student in Frankfurt via email a few months ago who said, hey, I have something for you. And we were very excited because it was the top piece, so it was a kind of like smoking gun for us. When you piece all of these fragments together, I'm showing you the front and the back. So the front side with the wide line spacing is in Arabic, and that's a Fatimid decree. The back side with much more narrow line spacing is a Hebrew text. It's a legal text of the 8th century, written in the 11th century by somebody whose handwriting we know. What these add up to, for my purposes, is a meter 23 of a Fatimid chancery decree, or at least the left half of one. The lines are cut off, alas. So what that means is that this was a decree that was sent from Cairo to a provincial official to resolve a dispute over irrigation rights, probably irrigation rights somewhere in Lower or Middle Egypt. So we know from the archive at St. Catherine that a single Fatimid decree could run anywhere from between 3 to 10 meters long. These things were enormously long, kind of like pompous-looking fancy scrolls with great calligraphy and great big line spacing, what a colleague of mine calls the sovereign privilege of waste. They're supposed to really look pretty, you know, pretty impressive. This decree, I can tell from reconstructing the bits of the text around what survived, was on the longer side. But a meter 23 is certainly better than I thought we could do when I started this project. So what was this doing in the Geniza? So the first thing that you notice if you spend any time with this material is that consistently the decrees have ridiculously wide line spacing. So while this makes them look impressive to their recipients, it also makes them vulnerable to recycling and reuse, right? They're blank on the verso, and on the recto, the line spacing is so wide that in a pinch you could write between the lines. And so that, in fact, is what somebody did. Somebody named Ephraim ben Shmaria in the 11th century needed to write out a homiletic text based on this 8th century legal work for a sermon that he needed to deliver on the Sabbath. He was desperate for material, and he was also desperate for writing material. So he took this Fatimid decree and he turned it into his Hebrew text. This was the smoking gun because this says Shabbat Bereshit, which means that he was writing a sermon for the first Sabbath in the annual cycle when the beginning of the book of Genesis is read. The fact that we can identify this person's sloppy handwriting. I'll just put that out there and say that he does not have the best handwriting in the Geniza, not quite as awful as Maimonides, but not as good as some of the professional scribes we have. He's one of the few hands in the Geniza that are completely unmistakable. And we know when he died, right? His florowit is between about 1016 and 1055. And that means that we know that he got his hands on this Fatimid decree about a century before the fall of the Fatimid dynasty. And that means that we know that this decree got into his hands not through regime change, but via some other means. It wasn't like the next dynasty came along in 1171 and they burned the archives or they sold it off as scrap paper and that's how he got this. No. We have to find some other way that this Fatimid decree got into his hands because it has nothing to do with the community of which he was a part. So this decree happens to have been a long scroll that was issued to a provincial official. We also know, thanks to the Geniza, that the Fatimids, when they wanted to have copies of decrees for their own archives, wrote them in a much more compact form. Because having all these long scrolls would have been enormously impractical. So to save space, they would write much more compact copies of them. This one is a bifolio, so meaning a piece of paper folded in half. And they bound them into codices. And in fact, if you look, if you peer into the margin, into the center, the gutter of this bifolio, you find four little pinholes where this bifolio was bound into a codex. And we also know that the Abbasids, that basically any Muslim administration from the Abbasids forward, kept their archives in the form of codices. In other words, these bifolios bound together in the form of the book as we know it today. That was their method of archiving. But if you were going to be issuing a decree into the provinces, I'm going to skip that little bit, they would take this much more pompous form. So what does that mean? That means that if you're a provincial official in Damascus or in Ramla or in Al-Bahnasa and you're receiving lots of these decrees from the central administration, eventually you're going to end up with quite a stack of them in your office, right? So what are you going to do? Well, you can't keep them around forever. These things are extremely difficult to sort of store in perpetuity. So I have a colleague named Petra Seipestein who works on slightly earlier documents on papyrus in Arabic, and she is of the firm belief that local administrators were in the habit of pruning their archives on a regular basis, which, she says, does not show contempt for documentation. It shows the archival mind at its most diligent and industrious. These people really wanted to keep, they wanted to run a tight ship when it came to documents. So it may be, right, archiving implies ordering, archives require maintenance. It may be that scrap decrees or fragments of them, the reason that they're all over the Geniza is that they're testimony to the energy with which provincial officials just jettisoned the stuff once they had enforced the terms of the decree, while it was the central state administration that kept the more permanent archives in Cairo. And I should just say that this was not the only... first of all, it's not the only place that we find scrap decrees. There are medieval manuscripts that are written on scrapped decrees as well. This is a later one from the 14th century. And we also know that Ephraim ben Shemariah himself, this scribe, this wasn't the only scrap decree that he used. Here's another one where he wrote a 10th century Judeo-Arabic translation and commentary in the book of Genesis by Saadia Gaon in a very strange recension. He was a guy who, he didn't just copy texts, he kind of did what he wanted with them. So here's another instance of him doing that. So in other words, the Geniza presents the possibility of reconstructing part of the Middle Eastern State Archive and also figuring out how it went missing. Of course, I never would have thought that the answer to the conundrum of the medieval Middle Eastern Archive lay in a Jewish synagogue. But once it became known that I was working on this stuff, I started receiving emails from colleagues saying things like, now I understand why this text of the Babylonian Talmud, which is like kind of the foremost work of rabbinic literature from late antiquity, contains these gigantic lines of Arabic across it. I never knew what they were before. It was almost as though, because the focus for a century was on the Hebrew script material in the Geniza, people had just ignored the existence of the Arabic and not bothered to explain it. And it was such an extreme situation that if you go into the 1906 catalog of the Bodleian Library, which contains 12,500 Geniza fragments, every time you see one of these Arabic texts, it's cataloged as scribbling. That's how illegible this material was even to specialists, and that's really how trivial they seemed even to specialists for a long time. But they're not trivial. And that raises a question, which is, did they appear trivial or illegible to the medieval Jews who handled them and who used them as writing surfaces for very, very different kinds of texts? So in the second half of my talk, which is going to be shorter than the first half, I want to try and answer this question. I want to try to argue that Jews knew exactly what these things were. They cared about them a great deal. And that it would be impossible for us to say that they were kind of ignorant of what these documents actually were. So by way of general background, I'll just say that Jewish letters of the Fatimid period are filled with an audible and kind of ongoing din of chatter about the state. You don't need to be focusing on the corpus of actual Arabic state documents from the Geniza to see that Jews are thinking about the state, and they're thinking about it a lot. Lurking in the Geniza documents is a striking number of references to titled officials, to rescripts and decrees. Here are just a few examples that I pulled out of rescripts, people getting rescripts for other people, canceling their tax. I asked him if he could take a rescript from the vizier to the chief qadi decreeing that my situation be examined. There seems to be a level of knowledge here about how the state apparatus works. We can understand why Jewish communal officials and even traders would have the state on their minds. Communal officials needed investitures in order to basically coerce their followers into doing the things they wanted them to do. Traders couldn't transport large shipments without government vessels to carry them. They had to deal with the state in the course of rendering taxes or in the course of avoiding officials by concealing their shipments with false labels, as Jessica has demonstrated. But it turns out that the state was also on the minds of regular people. And the best example of that that I can think of is this deposition from a rabbinical court in 1052. So let me just say what this is. Depositions are an extremely common genre of documentary text in the Geniza for technical reasons that have to do with the way documents function in Jewish courts of law. They're probative instruments, not dispositive instruments, so most legal documents take the form of testimonies. This occurred in the court, and we saw it happen. Sometimes these depositions, frankly, are completely opaque. You really have no idea what's going on. But every once in a while, you're in luck because they tell a coherent little story, and this time we're in luck because this deposition offers us a kind of glimpse, a kind of candid snapshot of the petition and response procedure and how subjects perceived it. In other words, if you will, kind of view of the end users of Fatima Chancery documents. So the scene opens in the market of Saifain in Fustat, which is called that after the church of St. Mercurius Abu Saifain, master of the two swords. It's 1052, and there's a Jewish shopkeeper named Nahum who's sitting in his shop with a companion and a piece of paper, and they're laughing their heads off. And just as they're sitting and laughing their heads off, a couple of witnesses happen by, and here's what happens. We, the undersigned witnesses, happened to be in the market of Saifain when we saw Yehuda Rumi ben Yosef sitting in the shop of Nahum ben Yeshua, known as Ibn Shemmiya. Likewise, Nahum was sitting with Yehuda Rumi, mutual sitting together. They were laughing and joking around. We didn't know why they were laughing. Then Nahum took out a petition from the supporters of Yosef. We don't know who this is. May his rock preserve him. And on it was a rescript saying that it was permitted for them to hold prayers wherever they wanted. Okay, so what they had attempted to do was to secede from the regular Jewish community and kind of found their own splinter synagogue. So then Nahum showed the rescript to some of the people present, and they read it while he was still holding it and handing it over to no one. Then Yehuda Rumi took it from Nahum's hand and read it and contemplated it in its entirety and laughed. He gave it back to Nahum. Okay, so this may seem enigmatic if you're not accustomed to the genre, so let me just make a few clarifications. First of all, what this Nahum ben Yeshua is holding in his hands is specifically referred to as a ruqa, which is the Arabic word for a petition submitted to the state. And it's also described using two additional terms. First of all, it's mutarjama, meaning that it contains the names of petitioners on the upper left corner, which is a classic kind of standard feature of these petitions. And it's also endorsed with the taqiyah, which is a rescript, which is where the chancery grants the petitioners their request. So all of these Arabic terms belong to state administration and chancery practice. And the fact that the witnesses who happened to walk by the shop or the Jewish court scribe who took their testimony are using such technical terms for this stuff suggests that knowledge of the petition and response procedure may have been pretty widespread, right? That at least knowledge of the procedure wasn't limited to palace officials. And that confirms what we know from other sources. People knew how to petition, and they knew what they were doing when they submitted petitions. The second thing is, the petitioners who are laughing have asked the Fatimid Caliph for permission to secede from one of the Jewish congregations of Fustat, and they've been granted it. So why did the palace care? Why did they want to grant them this permission? In reality, the Caliph had absolutely no interest in regulating the internal details of Jewish worship, and but at the same time had very little to lose in granting petitioners what they wanted, and much to gain for their own royal image, right, as kind of dispensers of sovereign justice. So it's very likely that their Jewish leaders had tried to prevent them from seceding and put them under a ban of excommunication, which is always the first thing that rabbis did in situations of conflict over authority. So to get around the rabbinic ban, this group appeals to the state, which means that they knew or they quickly found out how to get a petition lodged on their behalf. And by the way, this is extremely common for Jews to kind of fight out their internal communal conflicts via the state but I won't go into that now. And then the last thing I want to say about this scene is the rescript that this Nahum is holding in his hands has a kind of aura. It's recognizable to the people present. They're taking it out. They're refusing to let it leave their hands. And then when boasting rights prove too tempting, they pass it around. They let others contemplate it. And they're also reading it. So it's widely understood that some Jews of this period who knew how to read Judeo-Arabic also knew how to read Arabic script. But if I hadn't read this deposition, I would never have known that your average literate Jew could read the unpointed and very cursive and very difficult chancery script that you find on these documents. The very script that the keepers of the Oriental manuscripts at the Bodleian thought was mere scribbling. So in sum, this deposition suggests a kind of familiarity with the petition and response procedure, that such familiarity could be expected of mere passers-by in the market. It also suggests that the recycled documents on which a lot of Jewish scribes copy their texts may have been fully legible to them, both as texts and as objects. Okay, so that's what's kind of typical about the scene, how the scene is, I think, representative of a larger situation. It's atypical because it's one of the very few pieces of evidence we find of kind of like the Joe in the street handling this material. Normally what you find is Jewish leaders petitioning named people whom we know because they've consigned a lot of their own documents to the Geniza, or else people who aren't Jewish at all. But here you see your kind of average Jew dealing with this process. The last piece of evidence that I want to present to you is evidence that the familiarity with Fatimid state documents ended up influencing the way Jews ran business inside their own communities. And I'm going to present that to you in a kind of graphic form. So first, by way of background, in the 1060s, so just after the deposition that we just saw, the center of Jewish communal administration shifted from Syria and from Jerusalem in particular to Egypt, together with a kind of large-scale administrative centralization within the Fatimid state that took place in the 1060s and 1070s. As the Jewish leadership kind of reorganized itself and recentered on Fustat, they began to adopt in their correspondence with other Jewish officials, right, in Hebrew script, a conspicuously new set of conventions that were borrowed directly from Fatimid chancery practice. So if you've been watching my slides so far, you may already have the sense that Fatimid documents of state look a particular way. They all share a kind of core set of features. First of all, they're rotuli, which means that they're vertical scrolls. Many medieval documents are. These are particularly long, right? They have like a particular kind of dimension to them. Two, they have a wide top and right-hand margin and little or no left-hand margin, and the top margin can take up as much as a third of the width of the page. It's a bit less here. Second of all, they have a tarjima in the upper left corner, the name of the petitioners. That's what these guys were referring to in their deposition. The script that they use is curvilinear, and it's arranged with a series of nesting baselines that run at about a 30-degree angle to the horizontal. This is absolutely consistent in this genre of document in particular. They have wide line spacing. In petitions, 4 to 5 times the letter height as measured from baseline to headline. And in the decrees, it's more like 8 to 10 times the letter height between the lines, except at the divine invocation, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, when the name of God is invoked, the rule of wide line spacing is flouted conspicuously and deliberately. The lines curve slightly downward and then markedly upward, and there's a stacking of words at the end of lines. You see that? How they're kind of like going upward there and stacking? That's not because they're running out of space. They could have spaced it differently if they wanted to. That's a convention of these kinds of documents that contributes to the kind of appearance of the upward curvature of the lines. These are all consistent features of Fatimid petitions, and they're present in even more exaggerated form in the decrees. While other Arabic documents from the period don't look like that at all, I see this is an old version of the PowerPoint where I can't actually show you other types of Arabic documents, so you'll have to take my word for it. The changes I made this morning did not actually go through. In the 1060s, Jews begin for the first time to import this graphic style into Hebrew script documents. So I'm just going to show you the earliest example of this I've found. This is a petition addressed to the head of the Jews, Ra'isa Yehud in Fustat, asking for help on behalf of a traitor. So it's a totally personal petition. It happens to be addressed to the highest ranking Jewish leader in Egypt. Observe the graphic features of the Fatimid, of Fatimid documents. First of all, there's a vast top margin, more than one-third of the width of the page. There's a wider right than left margin. The line spacing is roughly five times the height of the letters, except after the divine invocation. The lines curve first slightly downward and then upward. And there's a stacking of words. The first time you see this in any Hebrew document, the stacking of words at the ends of some lines where space management wouldn't have required it, right? The scribe could definitely have gotten those words in. He's doing it as a kind of marker of, I'm writing an official document. So this is really for like diplomatics nerds, but I love this stuff, and I know at least one of you also does, maybe two. The other thing that this scribe does is he imports an actual clause from Fatimid diplomatics, which is called a ra'i clause, where you say to like the high-ranking official, this is what I want you to do for me, and then you say, oh, but the decision is yours. Right? And it's called the Ra'i clause because Ra'i means opinion, so the exalted opinion belongs to the lofty presence in this matter. This is a very particular iteration of the Ra'i clause that is only found in petitions written to officials just below the rank of caliph. So whoever wrote this petition really knew what he was doing. So, to move towards a conclusion. This Judeo-Arabic petition, first of all, marked the beginning of decades and decades of petitions to Jewish leaders and decrees and pastoral letters from those same leaders that imported the Fatimid chancery style into Hebrew script documents. It's such a marked development that actually if you study these features of Hebrew script documents, you can date some undated ones, which is a nice kind of technical benefit. I made this discovery last year when I had to write an article for the Festschrift of one of my advisors, and I was really excited about it. But there's also more than just the technical benefit to this. It tells us something substantively. It tells us that this scribe had not only read some Fatimid petitions, he'd probably been copying Fatimid petitions as models. It tells us that these scribes understood how the semiotics of the document's graphic features worked, what John Wansborough called the meta-language of chancery practice. So to put this in other terms, the diplomatic, in other words, the physical and technical features of the petition and response procedure started to become a structuring component among in official relationships among Jews themselves, internal to the Jewish community. So in other words, when you take all this material together, you start to have a very different picture of Jews' relationship to the state, or at least one that I hadn't seen before. That Jews learned from the state some very concrete techniques for furthering Jewish solidarity. Meanwhile, the state did what it could to encourage Jewish solidarity in other realms, which I haven't talked about at all today, but that's like a sub-argument that I'm going to make eventually in the book. It was a relationship of mutual benefit. And a relationship of mutual benefit that's led me to conclude that the sort of obsessively repeated idea or question of whether the state was good or bad for the Jews is really only an interesting question from a kind of stratospheric perspective or from a modern perspective. And here I have in mind a very troubling book by Ruth Weiss called Jews and Power. I would even go so far as to say that there's something going on in the relationship between Jews and the Islamic State that helps to explain the persistence or the resilience, or even the geographic reach of the particular construction of Judaism that survived the Middle Ages, which is rabbinic Judaism. You can't explain loyalty to the rabbis by just talking about the threat of excommunication, right? If you were excommunicated in one town, you just went to another one. People were enormously geographically mobile, and the power of the rabbis to actually regulate their behavior was fairly limited. Plus, you could always petition the state. So clearly there was something beyond coercion that was binding Jewish communities together, and that's what I'm looking for. And I think that one of those things was a kind of language of solidarity that was borrowed from the environment around them. I argued in a pair of articles in 2008-2009 that one of the things that bound the Jews together was a set of verbal idioms of patronage and clientele that had their roots in early Islamic ideals, and you find them all over the Geniza. And if that seems paradoxical to us, the sense of paradox is ours and not theirs, because this was a kind of language of reciprocity that crossed confessional boundaries totally easily. In what I've done here in this talk, I've tried to go a step further and to argue that Islamic statecraft offered Jews a concrete set of tools for communal governments and for solidarity. So the broad conclusion that this material suggests is, at minimum, it's worth giving very careful consideration to the kind of unintended effects of imperial administration on subject minorities. examining the evidence of the Geniza with an eye not just to the Hebrew script texts, as has usually been done, but towards kind of scribal traditions in contact across languages, across alphabets, and how documents circulated as objects, how they were exchanged, read, archived, deacquisitioned, thrown away, used as modeled, recycled, and so forth. All this has convinced me that for the Jews who filled the Geniza chamber with their disused documents, and even for Jews who passed their entire lives without ever dealing directly with the state or with a state official, the state was somehow ubiquitous. So petitions and decrees came to shape the way Jews wrote and thought, not just in relation to each other, not just in relation to the state, but in relation to each other. All this has taught me something about Islamic statecraft, to be sure, but also about the most intimately kind of internalist of Jewish history questions, which is how Jews organize their religious and communal life in the largest and most far-flung diaspora they've known to date. Thank you.
Thank you, Marina, for a really rich, I would even say spellbinding, presentation on the mechanics and the larger theoretical underpinning of this project of recording one's communal disputes and ordinances and regulations. We have time for questions and brief comments, so I'm going to open the floor now. And if you want to catch my eye, I will add your name to a queue, but I see we'll start with Mike.
Thank you. Do you have evidence that people send gifts with their petitions?
No. And in fact, the whole question of payment, whether the scribes who wrote up the petitions were paid and how the petitions were actually conveyed, it's all stuff that I'm getting from the paleographic evidence. So gifts, there's just no evidence that survived of it. That having been said, because the evidence for Jews in particular is so rich, we know that Jews relied on courtiers to get their petitions through the various offices that they needed to go through. So there was certainly some kind of, like, you know, connections that were being utilized, but whether there was kind of outright, like, you know, how do you want to call it, emoluments in that sense, we just don't know.
Yes, please.
You must be familiar with the passage from
Akkadi
Moments.
From?
You know, Akkadi Moments.
Yeah. Yeah.
When she presents himself as the personification of the chaos of justice.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how that notion of justice, which the chief judge represents, the chaos, and within the same tropes that you sort of raised, within, for example, what you see in the visibility of justice, how that sort of relates to what seems to be more kind of direct system, where the chaos is about personally feels to.
Right. So let me just explain the question, then I'll try to answer it or talk about why I can't answer it. So the text that Adam is citing is by somebody named Al-Qadi Nu'man, who's the architect of the Fatimid state in the 10th century, in the North African period. So he's the one who's really responsible for kind of like shaping Fatimid notions of justice. And he's a Qadi, right? He's a judge. So he's actually putting a lot of this stuff into practice for the first time. The Qadi actually talks about petitioning, and he's one of the chief perpetrators of this trope of then the caliph rode out on horseback and answered people personally. So on the one hand, he really wants to kind of like tell you this was just a completely personal relationship one-on-one between the caliph and subjects. On the other hand, we know that at least in the later period of the Fatimid state, petitions were handled by the chief Qadi. So there's a huge problem and a huge contradiction in the sources between what was the role of the caliph in administering justice on an ad hoc basis and how much of this was really in the hands of his chief justice. Some chroniclers say one thing. The documentary evidence says a completely different thing. It's not totally clear how these things fit together. And this is, so what I'm telling you is it's a problem I can't solve yet. It's something that Paul Walker and I have been discussing over email, and I don't know that we'll come to a solution. I may just present the kind of aporia in the book, and somebody else can come along and solve it later, but it's a problem that you point to, absolutely.
Maybe this is a little bit unusual request. I teach you the Arabic here, and we use Maimonides' texts. May I ask a favor to read a couple of lines from the first document?
Yeah, sure.
You showed us.
Absolutely. Putting me on the spot. I guess there's an easier way to do this, but I'll just keep going.
Excuse start from the beginning?
Yes, we're almost there. So you get to see all my slides again.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, it was the first one, I remember.
Yeah, it's back in the beginning.
Too fancy for your own good.
I know. Back a lot further than I remembered. Here we go. Okay. Can I read the first line anymore? I can't read the first few words. Anyone? Any help? Miriam? Someone? Anyway, then it says, Sheikh El.
Kulo Hadra Sheikh.
Yes, Hadra, you're absolutely right. It's probably Harav, Kvod something, Hadrat, Hadrat al-Sheikh. Something or other. And then...
Seems like some Hebrew word there too.
Sorry?
Lower down.
Lower down. Yeah, that could be. Absolutely. And then on the second line, he talks about the Ishtima, something be Yom Sibt. Fi Yom Sibt. Yeah, you see that? Fi Mahruch. Go ahead. Fi Mahruch Shiyuch. Okay. You getting the hang of this yet?
Mm-hmm.
You getting the hang of this yet? Of the choreography?
Thank you very much. Yeah. My mind is just to be happy that we read his work.
Yeah, right, exactly. So let me just say another word about Maimonides. The Geniza is completely going to revolutionize what we know about Maimonides. So one of the things that it does is that it's yielded autographed manuscripts of his works complete with crossings out and so forth. Anybody who attended the conference that Jessica just organized saw that there's now a function on the Friedberg Geniza Project website, which is kind of the main digital repository for all Geniza documents, that uses facial recognition software in order to capture an image of the text and show you texts that look like it. Exactly the same thing as like when you go to Google Images and you have an image and it shows you similar images, it's the same type of algorithm. And what that means is that you can plug in this text, and what it's going to churn out is a whole bunch of other texts that look like it might also have been written by Maimonides. And there's a new kind of like, you know, more detailed version of the software that was just unveiled to us for the first time 2 days ago, mm-hmm. which has a much higher accuracy rate, with which the person who devised the software, Ronnie Schweika, the same person who found that gigantic join that I showed you, because he's both a computer expert and a scholar of this material, was able to identify 30 new documents by one of the scribes that we know from the Geniza, and apparently there are new works of Maimonides, new, you know, texts of Maimonides, both documentary and literary, that are coming fast and furious. So for anyone who's interested in Maimonidean studies, this is an extremely exciting period to...
Does it include a letter that he wrote to his brother who was drowned?
That's an oldie. Yeah. The letter he wrote to his brother has been known for...
That one was preserved in the Geniza.
Yes.
The one that his brother wrote to him.
His brother wrote to him, or he wrote to his brother who came back.
The letter to the merchants, it's his brother
wrote to him. No, the whole long letter that he wrote...
Okay, I see a number of hands, and I'm going to call on you in 1 second, but I'm going to insert a question, if I may, because unfortunately I'm going to have to go in about 10 minutes, at which point Sarah will take over. So in hearing your talk, I would divide it into three parts. You began by talking about this notion of sovereign tribunals of the Fatimid Caliphate. Mm-hmm. You then moved to this detailed description of the physical and textual dimensions of these documents. And then you concluded by offering some considerations about the way in which the Jewish community mimics and absorbs the textual practices of the Fatimite court mechanisms. And I'm wondering, I mean, there are lots of questions that arise. I'll just pose two of them. First, how actually would you characterize the relationship, therefore, between the Fatimite regime and the Jewish community? And how would you push further in theorizing what the nature of that relationship really is. Meaning, would you describe it as David Sorkin described the German Jewish community in the 19th century as a subculture, as a microcosm, as an integral part, as a school of fish in a body of water, like other schools of fish? How would you characterize the nature of that political, cultural, osmotic process? And then what do you want to say about sovereignty and sovereign tribunals that relates back to the Jewish community? Is the Gnezen an instantiation of a sovereign tribunal? And if so, what does that do to our understanding of medieval sovereignty? Mm-hmm. What does it tell us about the features of medieval sovereignty? And I suppose I would just append, is this sui generis? Is this a model that is replicated on a smaller scale in many other parts of the medieval world, maybe in the Levant? Or is this including the Gnezen at scale without parallel?
That's what I wanted to ask.
Why don't you just jump in with your question, then, and we'll pick up.
Theorize the relationship between what you see in adopting the semiotics of petitions. What does that mean for the Jewish community? That's
okay. So I just want to compile the queue of hands that I saw. I saw Sarah, Jessica, and our friend the doctor in the corner. Anyone else?
Ranan.
So I'm here for another 7 minutes, please.
Okay. I heard at least 5 questions in your question.
That's half of it, too. Yeah.
So first, how to characterize the relationship between Jews and the state. So there are a few kind of theories out there that the historiography on Jewish communities in the last kind of 20 to 30 years has offered up. One that I'll tell you what I find useful and what I don't find useful. And here, I just want to be straightforward and say, I love to think with models. I think they're terrific heuristics. I think when you focus too much on one model, it's always going to obscure things as well as reveal things. So I like to work with lots of different models. So I'll just tell you the ones that I found useful and the ones that I'm moving away from. Ivan Marcus coined this idea of inward acculturation, right? When Jews kind of take idioms or motifs or narratives or habits from the surrounding cultures and put a kind of Jewish twist on them that indicates that they're sort of like, resisting, but resisting precisely in the language, right, that they're resisting. This is kind of like paradoxical relationship. So, an example of this is when Sadia Gaon in the 10th century compiles a dictionary of Hebrew and Arabic, and he says, the reason I'm doing this is the Muslims know Arabic so well, and we Jews don't know Hebrew well enough. So I'm going to be like them in order to make us less like them. That I found to be helpful. What I haven't found to be helpful is a kind of model of the Jewish community that proposes that it's a pyramid in which you have sort of like the lower strata of the community and then you have the leadership, and the leadership are connected at a single point to the government. Right? That's kind of the old model of Jewish communal autonomy that says Jews were basically left alone to run their communal lives the way they wanted to, and it was one person at the head who negotiated with the sovereign. That's just not true. People were negotiating with the sovereign all over the place, going outside of this pyramidal structure. So it's a much more kind of lumpy or baggy or jagged shape of the community, which in turn, I think, has to force us to rethink what communal autonomy means and what it doesn't mean. Communal autonomy doesn't mean that everything's happening inside the community, right? It means that certain things are happening inside the community and certain things aren't, and that people are using strategies to decide what kinds of conflicts, for example, they're going to resolve in the community, what kinds of conflicts outside. This sort of forum shopping, which Jessica has worked on, there's nothing particularly medieval about it. And you didn't even have to be particularly like clever or devious to do it. It was just what you did if you lived in a legally pluralistic situation. So that's something that I found, I wanted to move away from the pyramidal model of the Jewish community. You asked also about what does this tell us about the state broadly. So here I would say one of the things that I found most surprising about this material is that the kind of going theories of medieval Islamic sovereignty and also of pre-modern statecraft in general oscillate between two extremes that nobody's really tried to take into account, take into hand and resolve. One extreme is autocracy, is Oriental despotism, right? The idea that states are extremely centralized, they're trying to, you know, manage natural resources. Irrigation is particularly important. It's very important for the Fatimids. They're constantly like rebuilding canals, draining canals, you know, celebrating the inundation of the Nile. I mean, they have to like they have to feed people, right? So this idea that, you know, land is owned by the state unless otherwise indicated, that all of the rights and privileges you know, inhere in the state unless otherwise noted, right? This kind of like centralization of resources. That's one model. The second model, and if you study comparatively pre-modern societies, you realize they're really low on manpower. There's nothing like modern states the way we think of them. They can't police things. They're totally thin on the ground. And the only way that they can really get anything done is to use local elites of one variety or another to kind of run things on the ground. So that's what I found to be true of the Fatimids, that the Fatimids are very invested in fostering local elites. And one of the local elites they foster is the Jewish community of Jerusalem. There was a period in the early, kind of late 10-teens, early 10-20s, when the Fatimid state was giving a stipend to the yeshiva, the main rabbinical institution of Jerusalem. And then they stopped at a certain point, and no one knows why they stopped, and nobody even knows when they started. We just know that this happened for some period of time. And I started to think about why they did this. In the 1020s, you have lots and lots of Bedouin raids on various places in Syria, and the Fatimids had to raise armies really, really quickly in order to put down the Bedouins and like get the roads in order so they get the trade, you know, transit trade in order. And the way they did that was through special one-time taxes. And the way they levied taxes was they would say to the Jews, you need to fork over 15,000 dinars within, you know, X amount of time. Meaning, if you ask the head of the Jewish community in Jerusalem, the Gaon of Jerusalem, for 15,000 dinars, he can go ahead and use persuasion to tell his followers, go ahead and render the money. Whereas if you're the caliph and you're asking the Jews for this money directly, you have to use coercion, right? So the Fatimids are doing this with other communities as well. They're doing it with the Copts in Egypt. They're doing it with emirs, in other words, with kind of vassals that they have both in Central North Africa and in Yemen. And they may be doing it with the India traders, too. In other words, they're trying to sort of like extend their sovereignty through local elites, and Jews function in this wider system of like imperial sort of management.
Okay. Sarah, you're up.
I'm up with the question.
Yeah.
So like David, I'm kind of interested in grabbing on for a moment to this, to the larger frame,
yep.
Especially because I can't possibly, in a way, you know, speak to the fine grain nuances that you very masterfully lay out. But so your conclusion sort of surprises me in a way, because it seems to me that you could be building towards an argument that's actually about the erosion of community solidarity. And yet you're returning, and I wonder why. Are you returning because, as a scholar of Jewish, you know, I mean, you're who works in part on things Jewish, that one needs some, in the end, despite the desire to blur various boundaries in your earlier work between, you know, Jewish communities here, a kind of state, despite that, one needs something that creates a kind of conceptual logic, almost disciplinarily or institutionally. Because it seems to me that you have a momentum building. It has an aesthetic dimension. It has a discursive dimension, you know, a stylistic dimension that all points to, potentially could point to something else,
right,
which is this ever erosion of community, blurring and weakening and undermining. So I'm kind of, I guess my question would be why. Why do you go, in a way it seems almost to reach back,
mm-hmm,
to a more traditional theoretical, and yet not at the same time, because,
right,
your path is so non-traditional.
Right.
So what's kind of at stake for you, or how do you get there?
So your answer is in your question.
Okay.
Very Jewish answer.
And
your answer is in your question, in the sense that what you've done in the question is to set up a dichotomy between the maintenance of boundaries and the erosion of boundaries.
Yes, right.
And what I'm seeing is both. Mm-hmm. So in other words, that kind of dichotomy, I think, is actually not a very useful way of managing the whole problem. Like, there have definitely been, I mean, you're right, you know, obviously, two sort of countervailing tendencies in the historiography, and you could potentially see that in my work, too, which is the idea that, you know, Jews are always like the people around
right.
them versus
right.
Jews are never like the people around them. I'm asking the question from a slightly different point of view. This is a society in which confessional divisions mattered, right? But that doesn't say anything about how they mattered, or why they mattered, or how they mattered on a quotidian level.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm really trying to map out is where they mattered, where they didn't matter, and also the ways in which the divisions just break down. In other words, the vocabulary, I mean, just to take this example that I talked about a lot in these articles from 2008 and 2009, there's a very specific vocabulary of reciprocity and loyalty that emerges in the first three centuries of Islam, and all of it is based on the Quran. So, for example, the rhetoric of benefaction originally is this thing where, like, God benefits human beings. Eventually, the rhetoric of benefaction of ni'mah comes to refer to relationships between human beings. And that is something that Jews, like, they go crazy with it. They use it all the time. They're constantly using it as a kind of rhetorical device, like, you owe me, buddy, that kind of thing. But they're doing it in this vocabulary that if you actually are a reader of the Quran, it's a very theologically laden vocabulary. But they're not using it in a theologically laden way, right? So I don't think it's really helpful to approach the issues in terms of, like, you know, is this Islamic or is it Jewish? It's a question of how communities manage to maintain solidarity. The fact is that the Jewish communities, as mirrored in these documents, and granted there's a source bias because the documents come from kind of the pulsating heart of the community and not so much from the peripheries of it, they talk about community. They talk about themselves as a community. They talk about themselves with a vocabulary of sometimes solidarity, sometimes more like individual reciprocity, and sometimes different strains come to the fore. The 11th century documents are much more about reciprocity, meaning, like, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. The documents from the end of the 12th century and forward are much about, like, we as Jews, as a group, right? And you have different emphases in different periods, but the point is it's all drawing on a kind of Islamicate, you know, broader Islamicate vocabulary. I think I might have just restated the problem instead of really resolving it, but, I mean, the point is to say that I didn't come to this material, like, when I came to the Karaite Rabbinite material, the first book that I wrote, which was on heretics in the Jewish community, I was like, it's so obvious to me that the boundaries were more porous. Let me argue for that. I didn't really come to this with a kind of historiographically based, you know, preconceptions or, like, bug, you know, in my ear. And so I'm just trying to call it like I see it. And what I'm seeing is, you know, that the old categories are not really helpful.
That's interesting. So I have inherited from David a list of people whose hands are up, and I see Jessica. I'll be moderating the rest of the discussion, and I see Jessica is next on the docket.
Okay, I'll try to be brief.
Thank you.
Concise, so let more people speak. So I mean, this is so fascinating and just dovetails so fantastically with some of the stuff I'm working on and the book that I'm hopefully finishing soon, which is on obviously a much more modern context, but nonetheless you see a lot of the same things. So I wanted to sort of push you a little bit on the question of, you know, why was it useful for the Falkland State to respond to these petitions, and particularly why for Jews? And I wonder two things. First of all, could Jews constitute another symbol of the weakest members of society, like the unprotected woman, which is something that I see in 19th century Moroccan rhetoric, that Jews, like, protecting dhimmis is like protecting women. And then secondly, might not responding to individual Jewish petitioners work in largely the same way as responding to individual Muslim petitioners as a way to get around officials or to undermine officials, except to undermine Jewish officials? In other words, by responding to those people who wanted to break off to another synagogue, was it possibly a way of, like, sticking it to the
Jewish leaders,
the Sheikh Mahmoud? Maybe. I don't know, and I wonder if you ever see that. And then the second question is about my own interests, which have to do with, as you said, political pluralism. To what extent do you kind of understand the petitioning process as part of a broader legal system, or do you see it intersecting with, say, the system of Qadi courts and the system of Batei Din and other informal and formal legal institutions that existed? And, you know, I don't know if you want to actually take time to respond to these now, but
those are both excellent questions. They're sort of gigantic,
yeah,
but I will address them just briefly. the question of responding to Jews as sort of the weakest members of society, there is a little bit of rhetoric in the rescripts and the decrees about how the caliph is the protector of Vimmis.
Really?
That having been said, there's no... I mean, the other thing that you see in the rescripts and decrees is the leader of the Jews should handle this case in accordance with the law of his madhhab, of his legal school. Meaning, you know, there's this kind of like granting of power, delegation of power into the community that suggests that he's not really viewing them as powerless. So I'm not really sure it's a question of like power versus powerlessness. I think that there's a fairly consistent rhetoric in these documents, which actually touches on your second question, which I'll get to. And the rhetoric is, it's predictable. It's predictable rhetoric about how the caliph in his beneficence has ordered that your petition be answered positively and that its terms be enforced in accordance with either what the local qadi says because he's the governor or with what the leader of your madhab, whether you're Jewish or Christian or whatever you are, says. Just it's like a rubber stamp, basically. They don't care about the details. They just want to look good. The second question is, how does this intersect with broader legal systems? This is a really interesting and really big problem that hasn't been solved yet, which is the question of non-shari'i justice in Islamic societies. In other words, the justice that takes place outside the context of what we know to be Islamic law, which is the law of the jurists. There is clearly a consistent set of procedures and of arguments that are being used across this documentary corpus that suggest that it is a legal system. And it's a legal system that's taking place outside of the qadi courts. It's another means of recourse for Muslims, not just for Jews and Christians, and that it kind of adds to the whole sort of forum shopping experience in this society. But the theoretical question, this is the last thing I'll say about this because it's a little bit technical, but the theoretical question is a very interesting one. When you read the jurists and what they have to say about these sovereign tribunals, they're making it look like it's a form of shari'i justice. And why are they doing that? They're doing that because they want to say to the caliph, you got to do it this way. You got to keep in mind our way of doing law. And why are they saying that? Because they want the sovereign to listen to them. They want the caliph or the sultan to say, okay, you're going to be the guy who's going to tell me how to run my government, right? And I'm going to look really good religiously, and I'm going to like give you a position, you know, at my court. In other words, there's this whole problem of kind of, you know, of siyasa sharia, of trying to justify sovereign behavior according to the sharia, but it's completely ex post facto, right? They totally have their own system.
Ron, you still have a question?
Thanks, you set up in part of your talk a compare and contrast with medieval Europe and the situation, the documentary situation, the archival situation there, where the Roman world comes in is to acknowledge that there are certain potboi that recur, say, the emperor on horseback, direct justice.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, not so much about the calligraphic habit, because I think there is a very particular set of evidence, but sort of looking back to the world and laterally to the Byzantine world, the dimension of codification. Why don't, if there is in part, not that I'm claiming in any way that this is a sub-Roman society, but why are we not seeing a codification habit that could have been available to the jurists that would have given us a highly selective body of rescript law, for example, if that's in fact what Theodosius II and Justinian did, and second, in the 10th century, kind of chancery, that sort of an intensive project of re-editing the past that's going on in the Byzantine court in the 950s. That seems to be a sort of proximate model. If you compare and contrast those two aspects of the project to these kind of earlier society or contemporaneous empire, are you seeing similarities and differences? And if not, why? How do you explain the Fatimid sort of
right. Dude, I have no idea. I can't answer your question, but I can at least tell you where I'm going with that, with the Byzantine comparison, because it's a very important one. For me, the really important bits of Byzantium, of Byzantine legal practice, have to do with the legacy of Byzantine rule in Egypt. So I'm not looking to the, you know, imperial capital when I'm looking at Byzantium. I'm looking at the provinces. So the book on this was written by Patricia Crona, Roman Provincial or Islamic Law, talking about the roots of Islamic, certain parts of Islamic law, and basically saying that they're totally Roman Provincial law, just like, you know, warmed over, which is pretty much what we'd expect. All the more so with the administrative traditions, and all the more so with the traditions of petitioning. So this is a problem that I'm on leave starting in January, and the first thing on my list I need to do is read up on petitioning in Byzantium, because I suspect that there are continuities. I also suspect that there are differences, and to the extent that we can understand what those are, then we're going to know what's specific about kind of Islamic representations of sovereign justice. Codification, I have no idea. I just don't know. And there may be people here who can answer that.
Mm-hmm. I know there's one more hand to my right. Are there any other questions? So maybe what we'll do is gather two questions.
Great.
And let you have the final word. Do you want to go first and then Alma can talk?
Thanks for the wonderful paper. I was wondering if during your research in the Guineza, particularly with your angle on the relationship between the community and the state, whether you can reflect on maybe an analog with regards to the internal communal dynamics and response of literature towards halakha and Jewish legalities on two levels. Number one, on a practical level, where you talk about the language, the tools of statecraft, and perhaps how that maybe crossed borders into Jewish legal texts or halakha, which is somewhat similar in a sense. You know, a local communal leader or a local individual writing to somebody, a centralized authority, and the ways in which they receive that authority, not being local. And the second level is sort of the methodological framework that you set up that I think also reflects on response to literature, maybe as a unique genre, something that hasn't been done until now, but perhaps looking at it from a legalistic point of view, using the Guineza documents and being able to compare them might be useful.
That is a really, really interesting pair of questions. So let me just fill in a little bit of background. So this period that I'm studying, or actually the period slightly before the period I'm studying, is one in which rabbis are writing responsa, meaning legal answers to legal queries. And the first evidence that we have of responsa in this period comes from the 8th century, meaning we don't have evidence of responsa when you'd expect it, which is in the Roman world when there's this whole system of epistles. I mean, that's what the whole New Testament is about, when there's this kind of like diocesan system that's being put into practice. Like, that's when you'd really expect the Jews to start doing that. But they don't actually start doing it until the Muslims come along. That may simply have to do with geographic spread, that the communities were more contained before the Islamic conquests, and once they spread out, there was much more of a need of this kind of epistolary, you know, legal inquiry. Certainly, you know, transportation, in other words, the ease of actually getting responsa from one place to another had a lot to do with this. So I tend to view responsa in, like, pragmatic terms like that. In terms of what's going on in Islamic law, there's no question that Islamic law has a totally decisive impact on Jewish law, both at the level of substance and at the level of form. And it comes out in a bunch of different ways. So Sarah Strumza's recent book about Maimonides argues that the period of time that Maimonides spent as a crypto-Jew under the Almohads, and now it's pretty clear that Maimonides' family converted to Islam and then he reverted when he moved to Egypt, meaning that he spent some period of time actually studying Islamic law in a very particular iteration under the Almohads. She argues that you can actually see that in his codificatory literature, that the way in which he structures law has to do with Almohad jurisprudence. That's a pretty radical argument. At the same time, I mean, why wouldn't he? You know what I'm saying? In other words, why wouldn't this be the case? Gidon Lipson made a similar argument about the interplay of Jewish and Islamic law.
Professor Davidson argued exactly the opposite in his biography.
Okay.
So, I mean, there is sort of...
What do you mean? About the conversion or about the influence?
Well, I mean, at that... Yeah, he sort of questions the conversion and the influence and questions... I mean, his angle is less from a, I guess we'd say, pragmatic or sort of social history and more from a philosophic history. And actually finds parallels rather to the philosophical structures of Islam rather than codification and legal structures. So mm-hmm. I agree. I think, yeah.
What I'm saying is there's no reason to expect of Jewish law, just because it's Jewish law, that it wouldn't be, you know, that it would be immune to the to these kinds of influences.
But the particular angle that you presented of, not a traditional history where it's an influence, an intellectual influence, you know, what was Maimonides reading? He was reading Arabic philosophy and therefore, but rather from a sort of bottom up in the communal, not only communal issues that he's in, but the structures, the legal structures that exist.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of documentary evidence have you found in Mikinisa, that sort of documentary evidence, the crossover between halakha and responsa and sort of the letters, the rescripts and those sorts of things?
Are you asking me if there are responsa in Mikinisa?
No.
Oh. So I'm not sure I totally understand the question.
Okay.
Well, maybe we'll keep.
Yeah, we can take it up later.
If you want, you can take that later. I think the last question goes to Alma.
Thanks so much for your terrible voice for a little bad.
No problem.
I found this really, really fascinating stuff. And I'm also so pleased that you're in the same room as Jessica Marvel, because I see these wonderful parallels in your work. And I have a question that I think hopefully will link your work and maybe some other people that were asked similar questions, but is the word solidarity that you evoke, and it's something, I mean, I work on the 20th century, and that means something very, very different to me in what I work on. And in this time period, I wonder what is your definition of solidarity?
What's yours?
We can talk about that later. What is your definition of solidarity in this time period, and how do you piece that conceptually together from your documents? And as you're working with, to my mind, a very similar set of questions, albeit in a very different time period from what Jessica's working on, that there are these very interesting deviations of how we use justice, what kinds of courts one can use for one use or another. I mean, I wonder how solidarity crosses those temporal boundaries within a similar framework of questions.
Right.
Kinds of documents.
Right. You guys are amazing. These are such great questions. I'll try to answer this briefly because I've thought a lot about it. And I have an article coming out on what I mean by solidarity and what I mean by reciprocity and what the interplay of them is in this society. But I'll just give you like the sneak preview. If you read Benedict Anderson, which is kind of like the guy, right, to read on this, arguably more than Durkheim, more than Weber, more than people who talked about solidarity from like the old school of sociology, what Anderson argues is there's a crucial shift in the early modern period between personal relationships, which kind of, you know, suffuse the old world, and this idea that you can be reading a novel in the same language as somebody you've never met before, and that creates a sense of solidarity between you, right? My objection to this Andersonian argument that I think has been pretty much just accepted everywhere is that there's nothing particularly modern about solidarity, and there's nothing particularly pre-modern about reciprocity. Mm-hmm. That you can find islands of solidarity in the ancient world. This is something that was argued very convincingly by Seth Schwartz in his book, Were the Jews a Mediterranean Society, where he argues that the entire Hebrew Bible, the whole thrust of it, was to be a kind of polemic against the institutionalized social reciprocity mechanisms that existed in the ancient world. That the idea is Israelites have solidarity by virtue of being Israelites, and there's a kind of egalitarianism there and a kind of flouting of the hierarchies of like euergetism and all the other sort of like patronage mechanisms of the old world. So that's an example of ancient solidarity. An excellent example of pre-modern solidarity is the early Islamic polity. Right? Islam arose in a tribal society, and the whole point of Islam was to create a solidarity group among people who had no reason to bond together. Right? That eventually kind of degenerates into the normal, regular old reciprocity mechanisms. But the point is, there is pre-modern solidarity. the Jews have this kind of solidarity in abundance. You see it in the documents starting in the late 12th, early 13th century, right around the time Maimonides. Just to take the argument from the other side, and I'll stop, of course we have modern instances of reciprocity. We just call them by different names. We call them corruption, the mafia, you know, sub-state, whatever, Hezbollah, you know what I'm saying? In other words, any mechanism that kind of uses patronage as opposed to rerouting all the kind of like social redistribution through some kind of central node, be it the state or religion or whatever it is, you know, this still exists.
The American electoral system?
Grand jury.
Academia.
Doctoral advisors.
Great. Well, we want to thank you, Marina, for a superior talk.
Thank you,
Jessica, for being the occasion.
This is a real walk after my brain.